Man, that sunset is gorgeous.
Grill, patio, sunset. Hard to get better than that. Unless you're browsing Carvana's inventory while you soak it all in.
Oh, burger time.
So sit back, get comfortable. Carvana's got thousands of cars under $20,000 just waiting for you.
I could stay here forever.
Carvana, where car buying meets comfort, meets convenience. Download the app or visit Carvana.com today. The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place.
Hello and welcome to the latest edition of the Culture Bunker, your weekend pop culture newsletter. I'm Alex Andreu.
And I'm Sian Pattenden. On this week's show, we are delighted to have with us Madness frontman Suggs, here to talk about everything nutty.
We're also watching Marvel's latest series, Hawkeye. Was it a 19 on a D20 or a critical fumble? And all you need is another Beatles documentary. We sample Peter Jackson's new epic on their Twickenham sessions, Get Back.
Plus, The Italian Job. Adam Driver, Lady Gaga and Al Pacino all star in Ridley Scott's House of Gucci. But what did film critic Linda Marek and I make of it? All this and more in today's Culture Bunker.
Welcome once more to the Culture Bunker. We are over the moon to have the legend that is Madness singer Graham Suggs McPherson with us today. Hello, Suggs. How are you? Where are you dialing in from?
Yes. Good morning.
Where are you at the moment?
I'm in Whitstable, down by the seaside.
Amazing. You're just about to embark on the Madness Christmas tour, aren't you?
We are indeed.
What's touring predicted to be like this year? It's the first time in a few years you've done it, I take it.
Yeah, it certainly is. Yes, yes. I mean, this is the fourth time I think this tour was postponed. So I sort of gave up being optimistic around 2020 and a half. But we're finally here. The moment has arrived. We did one festival in Portsmouth a couple of weeks ago, and it was really was like a packet of firecrackers. Yeah, it was amazing. I think the atmosphere is going to be quite hot and sweaty, I should imagine.
How was your annual Minehead House of Fun weekend? What does that entail?
A pound or two of flesh. And half of my brain cells. Yeah, for those who don't know, we take over the Butlins in Minehead for a weekend every year. We call it House of Fun. And it is a House of Fun. Yeah, it was fantastic. The atmosphere was amazing. I normally go out and see, because we curate the whole weekend, so there's lots of our friends and acts and DJs. But we weren't allowed to mingle due to insurance, COVID, cobbler's business, whatever it is you call it nowadays. But it was great. Yeah, thanks.
Wonderful. I once saw Status Quo play in that Butlins in Minehead. Please don't tell me it was like that. Bless them and all, but never mind. Also joining us today, we have tech writer and journalist. He's currently audience writer at the Daily Star. He's also a former professional pop musician. It's Michael Moran. Hello, Michael.
Good day to you, listeners.
How are you?
I'm fine. I'm warm.
Good. Are you at the stage where you're looking back at the year? What have been the most engaging stories you've been telling over the past 12 months for your readership?
Well, I'll tell you the most kind of uncontrollable story I told in the last couple of months. We've done this, you know, newsletters are a big deal in newspapers. And so to kickstart our new All Things Space newsletter, I wrote a whole load of features about space and space exploration, UFOs, all that, the whole schmear of that. And normally, with these things, when you're dealing with a scientist or somebody responsible, a grown-up, you have to kind of tease out the mad bit that's going to go in the headline, that's going to get readers excited. Yeah. And you have to kind of – there's a little game you play where you kind of – You have to look like you're doing the homework and be responsible. But then I was talking to this guy from SETI who was expecting to have to play the game with and have to be responsible and not be too hysterical. He was really hysterical. He started telling me that aliens were going to invade us and kill us all. Oh. And I was thinking, mate, that's my job. Chill out, son. He was going absolutely feral.
You had to calm him down.
Yeah. I couldn't remember which one of us was supposed to be the grown-up. It was insane. Anyway, thanks, Seth. It was a good day.
Crikey, my heart is beating faster than ever.
They're going to kill us all, man.
But you're also, you keep dipping your toe in with culture. Are you compiling any albums of the year? Are you doing any good stuff?
I don't really do the music stuff. Mm. And in fact, on a personal note, Pop Pickers, I had so much holiday left this year because of this weird year it's been. Mm. I'm taking virtually the rest of the year off. So I spent most.
Well, then you can just listen to music.
I'm going to. That'd be quite good. Watch me.
Yeah, wonderful. Well, before we move on.
A small reminder, you can get the Culture Bunker and all our shows early and without adverts when you support the Bunker and Patreon. That means episodes on politics, science, pop culture and more every day. We're still taking music requests for songs to play on the show. Suggest something in the comments on our Patreon page and post a link to the song. Some of you have already posted some choices and we'll get onto them soon. We'll see what we can clear and play. Just search Patreon Bunker Podcast to find out more.
He's played on the roof of Buckingham Palace for the Queen's Diamond Jubilee. He's also played at the closing ceremony of the London Olympic Games in 2012. He may have toured the land with his spoken word memoir performances, released solo albums, but he's also been the lead singer of English Institution Madness for around 44 years. I'm sure he's gulping at the thought. As a previously fully paid-up member of the Madness Information Service, yes, that's me, I got the quarterly fanzine when I was a kid, Suggs, it's a delight and a privilege to welcome Graham McPherson, the artist also known as Suggs. Welcome to the Culture Bunker. We're going to listen to Bed and Breakfast Man from 1979 to fling us back to the old days, and then we'll talk to you, Suggs, after that.
Oh, that was the Bed and Breakfast Man.
Bed and Breakfast Man there, from the first album. Suggs, where did you find your lyrical inspiration in the early days for tracks such as that?
Mostly I was inspired by Ray Davies, you know. I mean, I didn't have the greatest singing voice, and it just occurred to me also that I like the idea of singing in my own vernacular. And Ian Dury, obviously, is the very obvious one, mm-hmm.
Yeah.
But these were people who weren't singing in cod American accents. Not that I'm completely averse to cod American accents, but it didn't really suit the limited vocal range that I had. Lyrically, yeah, the same, really. I like the way that Ray Davies and indeed Ian Dury wrote about the smaller inconsequential things of everyday life and made them, you know, almost cinematic. And so those two, I suppose, were the biggest, yeah.
Yeah, and also they're London boys, aren't they, to coin
well,
a phrase.
Well, this is it, yeah. Yes. This is it.
Yes.
And a bit of Robert Wyatt, actually, as
oh,
well.
Oh, great.
You know, I could find easy to forget, but, you know, he was definitely in that firmament of people singing in their own vernacular and about ordinary life.
Mm-hmm. It also, Bed and Breakfast Man in particular, reminds me of The Ginger Man by J.P. Don Levy. Was there a point where you ever, with these influences, that it wasn't just music, but you were taking from other things as well, such as books, comics or TV?
Yeah, that's very interesting. Yeah, I mean, for sure, we all read. I mean, I was pretty useless at school, but my mum was a voracious reader, so that really saved me. And that, you know, obviously gave me the tools to be able to write songs. But Graham Greene was a big favourite of mine. Yeah, for sure, yeah. So you can hear things like, you know, characters from Brighton Rock, for sure, in things like The Bed and Breakfast Man. The other things were Samuel Beckett, ironically, we really got into.
Amazing.
Because, yeah, the play, what's the one... It's Max Wall, and he's just sitting there with a tape recorder going...
Oh, Crap's Last Tape.
Ah, yeah. Crap's Last Tape. Amazing, yes. It's a wonderful play.
And there's something in that, you know, and the surreality of that. And also Tommy Cooper was a big favourite. So, and it was interesting to discover that Samuel Beckett was a big fan of Tommy Cooper. And that surreality, which I think certainly informed some of the stuff that we did, and certainly the videos that we made were very much informed by that surreal comedy, black comedy.
You also had early success. I mean, you were barely out of school, really. And we talked about the Before We Was We book, which is fantastic, on the show last year or the year before. And it is all about Lee going into breaking into Lindsay DePaul's house and things like that. What was it like?
So eating cornflakes.
I mean, almost seemed like to us it's an overnight success for you. And you, as I say, you're barely out of your baggy trousers. What was it like being so young and being so famous, Suggs?
It was odd, you know, it was very odd. It was quite quick. I mean, we had played some of what they call the Jews, you know, playing pubs and stuff. But we only just recorded a few demos when we bumped into the Specials. And Jerry Damas, of course, who's starting Two Tone Records, heard the Prince and said, you know, do you want to put that out? And it really was a shock. A, to make a record, and B, it started to become successful, and then we were on Top of the Pops, and it sort of didn't stop from there on.
Yeah.
But it was kind of bizarre, yeah, to have come from, you know, really the backwaters of nowhere to this huge trajectory in such quick fashion. And I remember, well, after about 3 or so years, we were starting to get a bit weary, you know. It's also, we'd made a rod for our own back by being this really sort of jocular, you know, outwardly energetic band, and everywhere we went they were expecting us to dress up and be stupid, which we like doing, but when it becomes a sort of full-time job it loses its novelty. So, and in the end Michael Keeble player, I think around 1984 or 5, decided he'd had enough and went off to live in Holland, and it was kind of a relief for all of us, really. We'd all had young children and I think we all needed a break. I mean, nowadays, you know, people talk about that, you can take a break nowadays. But then we were still sort of in the era of the 60s where bands were supposed to keep going and going and going and going until they died in case you lost your place in the pop chart.
Yeah, you've got to have a single out every couple of months.
Yes, yes.
Do you think Madness were a product of their time, though, from reading the book Before We Was We, the school system, your fractured home lives? There's something very 70s about it, that you came from that particular time and that particular part of North London, which I know really, really well. My son went to loads of schools that your band members went to, so it's quite weird to see that. Do you think you were a product of your time? Could there be in Madness now?
Well, that's a very good point. Yeah, I mean, I don't think we would have got through very many stages of X Factor then. You know what I mean? So,
you would have been nicking all the, you know, the stuff backstage, stealing Simon Cowell's trousers, I would imagine.
Simon Cowell's face. Yeah, we'd have probably hit him. No, that's not right.
No, you wouldn't have done. No, that was
wouldn't have done that. Wouldn't have done that. No, yeah. Comically, you know, comically, just apply. Mm-hmm. Yeah. But no, for sure, I mean, there's so many elements of what you said that when you think about it, you know, it was a very different time. And there, I mean, I say there was what we call room to manoeuvre. You know, there were squats you could live in for nothing. There were empty railway arches where you could rehearse. Most of the pubs in Camden Town had function rooms, so you could get gigs pretty much every night of the week. And I think most of that particularly has gone. So the chances of being able to evolve a seven-piece band, I think, are much more limited nowadays, yeah. I mean, that just simple physical stuff, never mind the artistic element of what we were about at the time. Yeah, I think that's a shame, you know, but I think that's a general comment on the state of, you know, live music, you know, and unfortunately why, as we've all commented on, you know, most of the people who make it now tend to be middle or upper class because they can afford,
yeah,
you know,
well, that's
to
creatively,
job
broadly,
and
that's
afford
true
to live.
Yeah. I was going to ask, I mean, it leads on to how on earth have seven of you managed to stay together these years? You say that Mike left, but he came back, didn't he? I mean, you and you too. Who are the others who actually have the original band members? There's not many. John Bon Jovi's band, maybe.
That's a very good point. No, I don't know. I don't know many bands that have survived. And, you know, for a number of reasons, I mean, we were friends, as you say, you know, in the book, you know, from reading the book. So I think that helped a lot, you know, because when we did have the odd falling out or when Mike left, we were still in touch. It wasn't like we, you know, you sort of fell apart and sort of hated each other. We didn't at all. And that sort of, that tolerance, I think, has got us through a lot of difficult times. But, and also not going to court, I think, helps. You know, not taking it out to court.
That's a really good idea not to do that.
That seems to be de rigueur for most of these bands. Yeah, that's right.
Yeah, but it's rare. You're rare beasts. The political climate has obviously had myriad twists and turns over your 40-plus year career. Almost 360, some would argue. Everything is worse now, some would argue. But how does it feel having been a cultural signpost and a comfort blanket for many people along the way, given that your political allegiances were fairly obvious from the start?
Yeah, I mean, you know, primarily left, you know.
Yes.
But, you know, that's something that came... I mean, you know, we were really young, as you say, and pretty naive. I'm very fortunate to then have gone on the two-tone tour with the Specials and Selector and people who were slightly more enlightened, you know, and we learned a lot from that. And then it started to infuse the way we worked and the songs that we wrote, even though they weren't, you know, like you say, we were the best cheekies rather than the other ones. But, you know, and the P with a small, I mean, politics with a small P, I suppose you'd say, yeah. Yeah, it's bizarre because having been around for so long now, it's impossible to sort of comprehend even for myself, you know. The 80s still feel like 10 years ago to me, not 40 years ago.
Yes, it's quite...
We were talking about that. We were saying, you know, 40 years from when we started, it was halfway through the Second World War. You know, it's as if,
yeah,
you know,
yeah.
We've been listening to the Glenn Miller band, you know, if you sort of imagine that people are still listening to our music now. But no, and we've been through probably three or four recessions, which is a very odd thing. You know, apart from having seen, you know, a myriad of different musical forms and bands come and go, we seem to get a bit more popular when there's a recession of some sort or emotional damage going on. And I suppose because we are inherently optimistic people and, you know, we do try and enjoy ourselves. You know, our music has been about having a good time, even though we may have tried to get some more serious things into the songs.
Yeah. Are you shy of espousing political views nowadays as a band, do you think? Because the political debate seems so polarised.
Yeah, it's difficult, isn't it? Yeah, I mean, it's become so black and white. I mean, for me, a bit frightening, yeah. I mean, I'm not the only person, I think, thinks that. You just got these echo chambers, haven't you? And I meet a lot of people now who have absolutely no intention of engaging in the dialogue.
Yeah.
They've made up their minds, and that is a shame, I think. Yeah, really, yeah.
Yeah, yeah. But you can sneak in, as you do, as Madness. A lot of your songs are set in London still, maybe the one that doesn't exist anymore, the one that we were talking about earlier. You've got a song called Primrose Hill. I'm sure that would be a very different song now if you wrote a song entitled Primrose Hill. But you've got We Are London, NW5. You've got songs that are about London that don't have London in the title. Are you addressing a different town? Are you trying to pull something back? Or is there an acceptance that things are different, but it's still the place that you love and that is a character? Almost, it's like the eighth member of Madness.
Yes, absolutely right. Yeah, yeah. I mean, I'm not saying, you know, it's the best place in the world. I mean, if I was living in Paris, I'd feel I'd be writing songs about what I saw sitting outside a cafe in the same way that I do in London. But of course, I've bred in London, and so it's got a very important part of my life. But it's funny, yeah, because we wrote an album called The Liberty of Norton Folgate, and we were talking about making a concept album. And I said, what about making it, you know, the concept of that, you know, idea of London being like part of our lives and a friend almost. Chris said, what do you think, Chris, the guitarist, what do you think all our flipping songs have been about?
Yeah.
So it was almost like an excuse to write more about London. But, yeah, I mean, of course, you know, there's things that have changed and there's things I don't like. And I mean, primarily, that property's become such a sort of commodity and rather than just somewhere to live.
Mm-hmm.
I think that's a real shame. I think that's really damaged the sort of soul of London, yeah. But still, I love it, and I couldn't be anywhere else. I mean, I've been in Whitstable for the last year or so just because of the pandemic, and I'm really looking forward to going back to London just because of the people, the energy and all that other stuff that you only get there, yeah.
Yeah, well, there's a few of us still fighting to keep it.
Yes, yeah. Exactly.
Less developer-like. Can you quickly tell us about your own memoir performances, your solo work, in a way? You've got a Life in the Realm of Madness tour next year. This is your spoken word. If people aren't familiar with it, what's it about?
Well, I've done two now. This is the second one, actually.
Oh, the second, not the third. Yeah.
No, well, in fact, yeah. Anyway, it's the second one. It got curtailed. So I've had three goes, but in fact, I'm having another go at the second one without getting too confusing.
Mm-hmm.
But it's basically autobiographical, yeah. The first one was called My Life Story, very imaginatively. So anyway, that was the path we were going down. And then the second one continues, yeah. So the first one was kind of about how I got to being famous and the paths that I crossed and the crossroads that I fortunately went the right way down. And then the second one is about getting famous and the sort of ridiculousness of being famous and all that comes with it. So, yeah, I've got a keyboard player. We play a few songs and I just tell stupid stories and some funny and some sad.
Yeah, but I've heard they're pretty good and not just stupid. There's a lot about your mum. There's a lot about who, weirdly, my mum used to know, but that's another story. A lot about your upbringing. And actually, it's the, you know, some of it's the vulnerable Suggs, isn't it? Some of it's the you coming out of the nutty boy image and you are telling all.
Yeah, that's right. Well, fortunately, I wrote it with a very good friend of mine, who's a journalist, and he was just saying, you know, I just think you could do something more interesting than stand up or just, you know, funny anecdotes. Mm. And so we worked very hard at a sort of narrative arc, for, you know, want of a less pretentious word. But it does suit it, really. And he helped me a great deal, yeah, because it was things like my dad I'd never really addressed.
Course,
he was a heroin addict and died when I was very young. Then I later discovered actually died a bit later than I originally thought.
And you never met him.
And that was the poignant thing, is then I probably would have, you know, a couple of years, I would have been famous and then possibly he would have got in touch with me. I don't know. But things like that. And so, yeah, I mean, it starts a bit ridiculously with my cat dying on my 50th birthday, which was just the most sort of earth-shattering thing. It was my favourite cat. And apart from the trauma of having had my 50th birthday, it just seemed very unfair. But the cat then is the catalyst, without wanting to make too many puns.
Yeah,
The story, you know, and the hurtful things as well as the funny things in one's life.
Mm-hmm. And you can still get tickets. It's on from February, isn't it? Just so we put that in. We're going to play the Bullingdon Boys. Now, this was a surprise single, am I right, in 2019?
Yes.
Tell us about this. Who might it be about then? difficult one. Yes. Jacob Rees-Mogg?
Exactly.
Yeah.
I mean, who is it? Who could it not be about? It would be easier.
Well, it's Boris, I presume, is the main character in this one, before he made a twat of himself over COVID even more. Why did you release this?
Well, in fact, our keyboard player, Mike Martin, wrote this song, and it just made us all laugh, yeah. I mean, it's you know, it's got a serious undercurrent, obviously, which is the fact that, you know, the sort of ratio of people that come from Eton who end up in power one way or another is obviously completely outrageous. And then we just thought we'd make a bit of fun out of Boris while we were at it, yeah. So, and I think it's a rather jolly way of sort of letting off a bit of steam, as we say.
Suggs is going to reappear with his favourite record of all time and his current favourite record. But first, we will play the Bullingdon Boys from 2019.
We are the Bully Boys. Move late at night, don't make much noise. Up the stairs from the den, followed by our Batmen. These are the chosen few, and these are coming through. We know it's just what to do. It's Robin to rescue. Eton boys are...
Get Back is an epic three-part, eight-hour documentary by Peter Jackson of those notorious Beatles rehearsal and recording sessions at Twickenham Studios that led to the controversial Let It Be film by Michael Lindsay Hogg. Have a listen to the trailer.
We're talking about 14 songs we hope to get.
I've got a feeling.
How many have we already recorded good enough?
None.
Oh, yeah. And none of us has had the idea of what the show's going to be.
I've got a feeling.
I would dig to play on stage, you know. Nobody else wants to do a show.
I think we've got a bit shy.
Oh, no!
What could it be? Something in the way she moves. What attracted me at all?
Just say whatever comes in your head each time. Attracts me like a cauliflower until you get the word.
There is a show to be had, you know, once we get over the nervousness.
Take 10. Oh,
yeah. I think we should forget the whole idea of this show.
The me
meeting was fine, but then it all sort of fell apart in the end.
So what's our next move?
We split George's instruments.
But it's going to be such a comical thing, like in 50 years' time. They broke up because Yoko sat on an amp.
Sean, this is essentially a behind-the-scenes documentary about a behind-the-scenes documentary. Is it only directed at Beatles megafans, or is there wider interest?
It's a good question, and you have addressed, obviously, the question of meta as well.
Yes, very meta.
How much do we need to know about how much we need to know about how much we used to know?
I wonder if in 30 years there will be a documentary about Peter Jackson making this.
About us watching Peter Jackson making it. It's a periscope, isn't it?
Gogglebox.
A telescope of different experiences. I mean, I did write it down. Do you have to know the Beatles and know the Beatles to find the small interactions between four people that you don't necessarily know or never had an interaction with interesting? Do we have to understand who they are, where they came from, or can you come to it fairly cold? And I think you do have to be a fan. I think you do, for at least the first episode, which we watched, is almost 3 hours long.
Yeah.
And while it is incredibly detailed about the creative process, which I will never find not interesting, it also is about the asides. It's about, we're watching people who on the outside world, not in a rehearsal studio, are so immensely famous that they wouldn't be able to walk a centimetre down the street. This is watching them relaxed. So you do have to have that understanding. I have to be frank and say I think it was too long. It's interesting, and it's interesting they couldn't come up with any songs in the first few days, at least what I watched. They are really struggling. They're also well aware of the cameras. They're wearing brightly coloured jumpers and a different one every day. But it is excruciatingly in detail, and that's where I wonder if people will just drop off and maybe, you know, just lose interest.
It's interesting. I'm not a Beatles fan,
yes,
and I enjoyed it. So, and if you had asked me beforehand, I would have definitely said not for me.
Yeah.
Over a period of 4 years, director Peter Jackson went through 60 hours of footage and over 140 hours of audio using the same restoration techniques that he employed in They Shall Not Grow Old, his World War
One
documentary.
Which was an incredible documentary, yeah.
How does it look and feel, the thing? Do you think it has made a difference to how fresh and sharp the images actually look?
I don't know that it benefits from that. I don't know that the cleaning up of it does benefit, the colours being brighter, the skin looks smoother of everybody who's in there. They look, interestingly, they do look like it's just after Christmas. They had a jolly good meal all week, and they've been at the booze and stuff. They look sort of fattened up afterwards.
Paul McCartney looks hot. Like, for the first time in history, I found Paul McCartney hot.
Well, they're all, I mean, bear in mind that they're older than us, but in this moment, they're what, 26, 27? They're young men.
Mm. Yeah.
They're in almost, you might say, in the prime of life. I think they all look good. I think it's always surprising to me how good Ringo looks. You always think of him as the kind of the poor relation, looks-wise.
Yeah, I think Paul McCartney is the only one whose hairstyle and clothes haven't aged as badly, I would guess.
Well, I don't know. George was looking nice.
He shaved his eyebrow halfway through it. Did you notice that?
He's
got one eyebrow halfway through, which was weird. Michael, it is pretty fundamentally different in its narrative from the original Let It Be documentary, which they didn't like at the time.
Yeah.
Does it prove the power of editing in that it tells a completely different story for the same material?
I didn't get the sense it had been edited at all. I thought it was never going to end. Ed, whatever it is, 80 hours of footage. And I was thinking, yeah, they've cut it down to a tight 79. I loved the trailer of this. I really loved the trailer. I really liked, because the Beatles are very slightly before my time, but I'm aware of them as a cultural phenomenon.
Yeah, yeah.
I didn't really need that whole, whatever it was, 45-minute primer on who they were and what they'd done. But the trailer gave you the sense that you were going to be sitting with these guys that you've known all your life and watching them interact and having a good time, which is what I wanted to see. I wanted to see them having a good time, getting on, being mates, and kind of subverting that narrative that, you know, everything was rubbish in their dying days and Yoko had ruined everything. I didn't want to hear that. I wanted to see them having a good time, being mates.
Mm.
And
we tried that, though,
yeah, well,
didn't
the trailer
we?
Promised that. And then the actual thing, I was thinking, sitting down, looking forward to seeing these guys, who have, every one of whom is astronomically talented, just popping out this stuff. And again, oh, dear me. I mean, I've sat in studios with a bunch of blokes doing this. And it's great fun. It's really great fun. But for the first hour, and then it's like, oh, can we go home now? Mm. Can we all have a sandwich now? And that's how I got to feel. I just got to feel like, man, I love you. You're having, you know, you're talented boys. Every now and then they would just kind of be, Paul especially, would be like clonking away with this weird strummy bass style that nobody else does. And then you would hear this little diamond that you know that is going to be on the other side of Abbey Road. And it was a kind of, you know, they'd strung together all these little fragments.
Well, that's what, you see, that's what I loved about it. There's a moment where basically he's fiddling with his guitar and vocalizing sort of in falsetto. And Jackson just lets that run and run for quite a long time. And from that emerges Get Back in pretty much its final form as he's doing it. And I just had a sense that it's like watching, I don't know, Rembrandt doodle, that you're seeing really quite an ingenious musician in that process of just fiddling with something and see what they get out of it.
Don't get me wrong, I think he's a spectacular talent in particular. I think they're all brilliantly talented. I didn't need to see quite so much of the process. Some of the process is interesting and some of the interaction is interesting. You know, I don't think it quite warrants that. So, sure, you were going to get Beatles completists, people who pour through take after take after take of Love Me Do, an anthology. They're going to love this, and good for them. But it ain't for me. I would have really liked to have seen this boiled down to about 90 tight minutes, and I think it would have been very interesting. You know, there is a natural narrative arc of coming from, and I think, you know, people like Yoko gets the blame for being this. To me, the villain of this is Michael Lindsay-Hogg and his fanciful, oh, let's go to, where did you want to go, Tunisia?
Yeah.
And they had no space to just be themselves. They needed to just fart around.
But there are interesting moments, and they do discuss this. So they talk about Mr. Epstein, they call him, and it's been a year since he died.
I just thought he was so present.
That was fantastic, though, because they're saying we're lost without him. Yeah. He was our daddy. This is what they're calling him. And they also then talk about the Beatles, quote, divorce. Yeah. Who's going to get the children, says John Lennon. They are talking about the fact that they are disintegrating in front of their eyes and that not really talking. They're only talking when they're in this environment. And there are points like that that are absolutely mesmerising when you see real people discuss, you know, what is going to be the demise of the Beatles.
Yeah, when Paul McCartney says, I'm really scared about being the boss.
Which was absolutely...
You know, here, but if we're going to do a show in 2 weeks' time, someone kind of needs to grab it because from the scruff of the neck.
Those are the bits where it really sparkles. And then they talk about what's on last night's TV. It was actually seeing the process of people writing songs. As you say, I've been in the studio and watched...
It's interesting you should mention Yoko Ono, because one of the strongest reactions I had was when she first appears... And I had this visceral reaction to her. And then analysing that in my head, I realised it's based on nothing.
It's just based on this
misogynist notion, really.
And a racist.
Inherited, because she was before my time, that she's the cow that broke up the Beatles. And, I see her sitting there quite quietly and quite lovingly. And I see the Beatles really... acting like quite a dysfunctional family. And I thought, if I was in love with one of those four people, wouldn't I be telling them maybe the best thing to do would be to just...
But they've decided that themselves. Yeah. I mean, you could say that the Hare Krishna split up.
I love the Hare Krishnas.
That George has bought... on the first day, there was one Hare Krishna sitting in the corner doing nothing. But by day three, there's two. I'm hoping that by hour eight, there's going to be 20 Hare Krishna.
It was like that scene from The Birds. You know,
isn't it?
Where she lights a cigarette and you see one crow behind her. And then by the time the shot opens up, the entire Jungle Gym is full of them.
But also, you see Yoko and Linda at one point just having a lovely chat.
Yeah.
Which is not a thing that you necessarily... I've never thought about it before, but it's not part of the myth at all. That they seem to be getting along fine, and everybody's getting along fine, and it's cool. And I just, you know, like I say, there's a lot of good stuff in there. But if you're panning for gold, you don't necessarily keep all the dirt.
Yeah, I have to say, I'm not a Beatles fan by any stretch, and I don't particularly enjoy music documentaries. And I really liked this. I mean, I liked, there were lovely moments of them just jamming other tunes from Dylan to Elvis and folk and blues. I found the sheer material pouring out of them and the stuff they rejected really interesting. The process of writing lyrics, if you can call it that, where they just put anything that rhymes in and like tried for
yesterday
size.
Used to be called scrambled eggs, you know. They used to just make up nonsense. But also the other, it's not necessarily a revelation because I think a lot of people know this, but Ringo is such a good drummer.
Mm.
You can be the best band in the world. If you've got a bad drummer, you're screwed.
Yeah. Mm.
And the opposite is true. If you've got a great drummer, you can get away with murder. That often you hear them, you know, like George or Paul will be kind of just doodling around on something. And you're like, oh, this might be something. And then Ringo sort of listening and then he starts up. And the thing pops to life straight away. He's just a beautiful drummer.
That's what I felt as well. They are their own producers by this point.
Mm. Yeah.
These songs are fully formed once they are finished. They don't have to be in a studio and then have the George Martin or someone else tinker with them. Their ear is so good by this point. And Paul McCartney's ear, I was actually quite astounded by that, the musicianship, when it was not just the hours and hours of noodling.
But that's the thing. You could argue that by this time they'd outgrown George Martin.
Mm. Yeah,
but they had not outgrown Brian Epstein.
Mm.
That... You said earlier about they referred to him as this kind of father figure, and he created the scaffolding around them, which enabled them to remain quite childlike and therefore creative and playful, you know, through the Revolver, Sergeant Pepper years. All of a sudden, pop, you've got to be grown-ups. Paul's having a go at stepping up, but it's, you know, leads to resentment. It doesn't really work.
Yeah. The only other moment I need to mention is that, you know, with what's going on with... Channel crossings and immigration at the moment, there was an incredibly poignant moment where they were writing Get Back as a sort of song poking fun at racists, basically, as in get back to your own country. And there was a lot of sort of footage and newspaper clippings of all the Enoch Powell stuff. And that really hit me how... Now it is, how relevant it is, how it is exactly the same fucking debate we're having today.
Yeah.
And that was a bit disheartening. But so,
well,
so there you go.
And at the same time, you had George talking in almost worshipful tones about Clapton, who, within about 9 months
it
of that.
It didn't take long, did it?
No.
Yeah.
Interesting. So, two thumbs down, I'm guessing.
No,
it's actually a medium thumb. Now.
Okay, all right. Mine is a firm thumbs
yours
up.
Yours is a firm macro thumbs aloft.
I have to say, as a non fan, I'm really looking forward to the next couple of episodes.
I'm going to watch it all. I just feel like I shouldn't have to spend quite so long watching it.
Get Back is being released by Disney Plus over 3 days, with the last episode dropping on Saturday, the 27th of November.
The comfort of your favorite seat is now your comfy car selling command center, thanks to Carvana.
It doesn't get any better than this.
Your favorite seat's the best spot in the house. Make it even better by entering your license plate or VIN and getting a real offer in minutes.
There really is no place like home.
And speaking of home, Carvana will pick up your car from yours after you finalize your offer. Visit Carvana.com or download the app and sell your car from your comfy place. That's not just the sound of that first sip of Morning Joe. It's the sound of someone shopping for a car on Carvana from the comfort of home.
That's a good blend.
It's time to take it easy, like answering some easy questions to get pre-qualified for a car in minutes.
Talk about starting the morning right.
Just like customizing your terms so your car fits your budget.
Mm-mm-mm.
Visit Carvana.com or download the app to experience car shopping the way it should be. Convenient. Comfortable. Ah.
Regular listeners know that our esteemed panel always bring in a track for your delight. Michael Moran, it's your turn. What have you got for us today from your battered briefcase?
Well, it's brand new and it's 50 years old. it's actually a really interesting story. So I'm very fond of a band called The Meters, who are from New Orleans. I keep thinking that everyone's heard of them, but you've heard them because they've been sampled so many times. They're on so many records. But they're actually not as well known as I tend to think they are. But they are the absolute perfect funk quartet. And they're like a little clockwork, everything locks together. People use the word effortless a lot around them. It's not effortless. These guys have really put the effort in. But there was a period when the Meters lost their record deal in about 1971. And for about 6 months, they're just doing other stuff. And the guitarist, who I like to pronounce his name, Leo Nocentelli, I don't quite know how he would say it, decided he would make an album of his own, which is kind of influenced by, I'd guess, James Taylor was around at the time. It certainly feels like Bill Withers, Terry Callier to me, and a kind of soulful singer-songwriter thing. And there's some confusion about whether he'd intended it as a solo album or whether it's songs, you know, demos for other people to then pick up and take. It's a remarkable recording, which, you know, he had, I think, the Meters rhythm section, Alan Toussaint's on keyboards, beautiful playing. This one track, Riverfront, really stuck out to me as being just gorgeous. But then he stuck it away in storage because the Meters got another deal really shortly afterwards. And then it goes from being a tale a bit like Get Back to more like Storage Hunters, where the recording gets shoved in a storage unit, forgotten about, auctioned off as rubbish. This crate digger, one of the guys to do with the Beastie Boys, picked it up. And now it's been released 50 years after it was recorded. And it's a beaut.
OK, let's give it a listen. Riverfront by Leo Nocentelli.
It's all I have to do.
Now, Ridley Scott's star-stuffed and much-awaited House of Gucci is out this weekend. With turns from Adam Driver, Lady Gaga, Al Pacino, Jared Leto and more, the film promises to explore family, loyalty, money, bloody revenge and really expensive belts like never before. Film boffin Linda Marrick and I have seen it, all 2.5 hours. Here's the trailer to get us in the mood.
I've been a Gucci all my life.
Your name is in the history books.
Paolo, you are Gucci, you need to dress the part.
It's chic.
Gucci needs new blood.
It's time to take out the trash.
They're my family.
So am I.
You picked a real firecracker.
She's a handful.
So set this up for us, Linda. What's the story behind House of Gucci?
So it's a story about... I actually was not aware of it at all, to my shame, because it's a very well-known story about the wife of Maurizio Gucci, one the heir to the Gucci fortune and the fashion house, who in, I think, the early 2000s, hired a hitman to kill her husband. This tells a story from the beginning of their relationship till the end of their relationship, which culminated in the disaster. I don't think I'm giving anything away.
I don't think
it's
you
a
are.
Very well known
know.
Story. Which I am, to my shame, I didn't know.
She hires a hitman, doesn't she? Or two hitmen. This is obviously a plum role for Lady Gaga. She's not totally top billing because there are a lot of Oscar nominees and winners nudging her for it, but really it is her film. How did you feel that she was? And apparently she stayed in character for a long time during the making of this.
My problem with this film, I'm going to start by saying Lady Gaga, I think, was fine, but I felt like none of the actors knew what kind of film they were in. I think tonally, it's a mishmash of things, and I think Lady Gaga thought she was in this kind of campy, over-the-top, sort of stylized family drama. The rest of the cast thought they were in a comedy, so... Adam Driver was the only person playing it for serious. I mean, I can't fault her. It's not really her fault. It's the script is not great. And I think there was a lack of direction. So I can't completely... And I really love Lady Gaga. I love her music. I've always been a fan of her. So I'm not going to be too harsh. But I didn't find her performance convincing, in my opinion.
How did you feel? You say Adam Driver may be the one who's sort of got the tone right. He's wonderfully understated and he looks the part. He looks awkward and yet rich and yet troubled and yet, you know, he's intelligent and yet he doesn't seem to know quite how to handle things. He is guided by other people. Would it have been simpler if they'd all acted like him, I'll just say it.
I think so. But you said he seems, he looks regal. I think that's what I love about, he's a serious man. He's a serious person who can sometimes play it the silly part. I mean, we've seen him in Girls where he's completely, mental in that. But what I liked about him in this is the ease at which he sort of embodied that character. I found that flabbergasting. I honestly, that just tells me that he is one of the greatest actors at the moment in Hollywood. I believed he was Mauricio Gucci. I believed he was that person. And the script is obviously very sympathetic towards him. I think it tries its best to be a little bit more sympathetic towards her as well by the end. We all know who sort of the hero of the piece is.
Yes, yeah, we do.
Maurizio, really.
And as we say, the film promises a lot. It promises glamour because we have Gucci. It also promises this idea, and very much a Hollywood idea, of what Italian living is. They drink coffee. They are very passionate. They do all the things that Italians are meant to do. We're seeing it from that lens. Is the film dealing with these big issues? As we're saying, there's revenge, there's murder, there's passion. Is it dealing with that, or is this... What I felt and what I'm really getting to is the film, just the story is not big enough. The story is very simple, is a scorned woman gets her revenge. Is there enough to it in that way?
I think the story is big enough. I do. However, what I think is that the script wasn't up to the sort of the story. Do you know what I mean? It's not as big as the story. It needed something a little bit stronger. And I felt like, I mean, you can make a fantastic story out of this if you really, had a really good script. And I just felt like there wasn't, it felt at times like it was like a telenovela, like people sort of slamming doors. And I didn't believe them anybody's motivations. And I'm sorry to say.
Is this something that showrunner Ryan Murphy, who is enormously successful about making real stories into its series, the assassination of Gianni Versace obviously comes to mind, which was beautifully crafted in terms of plot. Is this something that could have been done better by Ryan Murphy or in a different format, do you think?
I wouldn't usually agree because I'm not a big fan of Ryan Murphy, as many will know. But in this case, I think I agree with this. I think in this case, this did need to be a kind of either a mini series or at least a 3-hour long mini series type thing. If you cast Jeremy Irons in a movie and you don't get much out of him, I just find that really quite insulting, to be honest, because he is fantastic in this, but we don't see him enough. Whenever he was on, I just wanted it to carry on because he really manages to embody that brilliant character of the sort of the old fading film star who thinks of himself as royalty as opposed to this sort of social climbing woman who's come to take his son. Like, I'd love to be more sort of more positive about the film. And I think there are bits in it that are really good. Like, the Adam Driver performance is an Oscar-winning performance. But other than that, I thought it was quite boring, to be honest. It was a bit dull.
Yes, and I think that's what they did with the story, is they turned something interesting into something that step by step. It is a shame because the elements are all there. That's what we're saying. The acting talent is there. The story is there. There is some glamour in it. There's not enough fashion to me. There was one nod to Versace. They're not talking about the fashion world at all. And the fashion world is notoriously crazy, full of really interesting people and totally bizarre. None of that gets in. But are you saying you'd recommend it?
Oh, definitely. I think go and see it. Definitely. I mean, when I sort of shared my print review on social media, even though I wasn't very sort of positive about it, I had loads of people replying saying, oh, thanks, your review really made me want to see it. And I think even a negative review can sometimes do that. So people should not be scared of negative review. I think this is a film that's going to do really well. And Lady Gaga has like a huge following. Adam Driver's got a massive following, as does Jared Leto. And I think it's going to do well. definitely go and see it. There's a lot to get from it. Whether it is one of the best films of the year, I absolutely not. But, you know.
All right. A warmish recommendation.
Yeah.
Lovely.
Warmish.
Thank you, Linda.
Now, we promised you that he'd be back with his favourite record of all time. And here it is. Suggs, what have you chosen and why?
We've chosen Waterloo Sunset. So, you know, you were talking to me earlier about the things that have influenced me. Yeah. And Ray Davies, for sure, is one of the biggest. I've read a lot of people who said that it's their favourite song, but they would never dream of covering it because it's just got an atmosphere, apart from the fantastic melody and lyrics, that you just can't capture. But yeah, anyway, yeah, it's just a sensational track. I really love it. It's got something magical and ethereal that you just can't put your finger on.
Hawkeye is the latest offering by Disney Plus in the Marvel Cinematic Universe. Jeremy Renner reprises his role as Clint Barton, a.k.a. Hawkeye, who, through a series of gaffes and coincidences, finds himself in a sort of guardian-slash-mentor role to Hayley Steinfeld's Kate Bishop, his number one fan, and pretty handy with a bow and arrow herself. It's a limited miniseries that takes place over 6 nights in a glitteringly Christmassy New York City. Let's get a flavour.
This is the first Christmas we've had together in years.
I love you guys. I'm making up for some lost time.
Authorities are wondering if the masked vigilante who terrorized the city's underworld is back.
The past has caught up with me.
Should we be worried?
No, it's nothing. I'll be home for Christmas.
I promise.
It's the
When I wore this suit, I made a whole lot of enemies.
You're a Hawkeye!
Who the hell are you?
Mike, why should anybody care about a series revolving around chronically miserable Hawkeye, who is, let's face it, the least good Avenger?
He is. I grant you, he is the least good Avenger. And Jeremy Renner does, for all the world, look like a thumb with a wig. But those things said, I personally really like the grounded aspect of the Marvel Universe. Like, so Eternals, with its cold Chariots of the Gods narrative, it's not for me. That wasn't me. And also, Shang-Chi even was a bit fanciful with the dragons and whatnot. I like the idea that this is just straight, you know, it's kind of hinting at a reprise of Daredevil, which was my all-time favourite. Mm-hmm. I love that show. And I'm kind of hoping that Kingpin will come back at some juncture. But it's New York at Christmas time, so what's not to love? You can just watch that and it gets you in the mood and you're thinking, oh, I might have a mince pie now. And there is this, as you say, this kind of like pseudo father-daughter mentor role. We open on the Battle of New York from 2012, but seeing from a street level perspective, and it's amazing.
So the series puts a bunch of familiar characters and their storylines in a bag and kind of shakes it in the way The Walking Dead often does, you know, where you have stuff that happened to a different character happened to this one. So Pizza Dog is now rescued by Kate.
Yeah.
It is Eleanor Bishop who survives as Soul Guardian. The Tracksuit Mafia are like characters from Home Alone 2.
Yes, bro.
And are sort of comic relief rather than danger. Will this annoy the comic fans, do you think? Or is it a way to keep it interesting for them,
I mean,
so that they don't know exactly what storyline they're looking
at. Yeah, I mean, yes, as you point out, so this is reinventing the Matt Fraction run in the same way that, you know, Age of Ultron reinvented Age of Ultron. It's always that element of remix and making it a bit screen friendly, which I think makes sense for both those reasons. One, people who've lived the Matt Fraction run will find something new that it'll be worth them watching. And two, it operates, it's very low stakes, you know, So these Disney Plus series, you know, WandaVision was quite mad. It was possibly my favourite of those. And Loki was quite out there and sort of Doctor Who-ish. Falcon Winter Soldier was quite grounded, but you had the opportunity for superheroics because one of the guys could fly. Every now and then when things got dull, he would jump out of an aeroplane. This has none of that. This just has Christmas. Mm. But I am so happy to be spending whatever it's going to be, 6 hours or 5 and a bit hours, in Marvel Universe at Christmas time, I don't really care. I don't care that it's no low stakes. I don't care that nothing much will happen. Some people have said, oh, it's a problem that nothing is happening. I'm cool with it. I'm just very happy to be around those people for a little, you know, mulled wine.
Yeah.
I'm for it. It's so me. The two things I really like in the world are Marvel Comics and Christmas. So they've got me.
Sean, over the years, Andrew has forced you to watch dozens of these things. You're a seasoned Marvel widow. What did you make of a superhero with no superpowers?
I felt that maybe it was a Marvel too far. The Marvel universe can stop. There is a boundary, surely. What I find interesting is that Marvel seems to be so much based on the Greek narrative, which we are used to. It's a fairy tale. It's a nursery rhyme. It's something that is solid that then repeats itself and does variations of itself. That in itself is interesting. However, the man with the bow and arrow and the woman with the bow and arrow may be just stretching it too far for me. I watched it with my son and we have watched a lot of Marvel. So he has also helped me into the universe.
Okay.
But we did feel that maybe it's played too straight. Maybe it is too straight. There's something that is lacking the fun of it. And I know they've twisted things around and some of the tropes are different and some of the characters are now doing this and there are new characters. Mm. And yet I didn't think it was as playful as it could be. Whereas Loki, you know they're having fun writing it. You know they're just going, oh, hello, then we do this. And then
do you think, with its less sort of threatening colour palette and, you know, taking place over Christmas, having a plucky young adult at its centre, is it a sort of Disney Marvel crossover beginning to happen? Are they preparing things for their younger, sort of more traditional
Disney audience?
The Disneyfication
of it, yeah. And say there is less fun. It does seem more computer generated. Oh, this will target this age group. We've marketed to this age group. It does feel like that. And that takes the sort of joy out of it.
Michael, the first episode featured Rogers the Musical.
That was a good one.
The big number and displays, I could do this all day. And the showrunners actually brought in the creative team behind the musical Hairspray to write it.
Now,
did it tickle you?
Oh, man, I was actually watching this thinking, what I really want is a secret seventh episode that's just Rogers the Musical.
I agree, it's the strongest bit.
Because it's like the MCU's Hamilton, isn't it? It kind of retells history.
And suddenly Katniss appears in it from the Hunger Games.
She's in the street,
What's going on?
But, you know, and you can see Hawkeye on the one hand railing against the fact that Ant-Man shouldn't have been in there. And the other hand, you see his little PTSD kicking in. I also thought it was a pleasing touch of realism that he's got this hearing damage from years of combat, which, you know, I don't know whether it will actually become a plot point, whether they'll forget about it, it becomes inconvenient in future episodes, but it's interesting that it's there.
One other thing I liked was that black market auction of Avengers merch, Avengers things, where there is becoming more and more meta. We do know that the Avengers are now a thing. It's not a secretive thing. Everybody knows about
them
and is riffing on them.
Between the musical,
there were some
ideas
that were extremely good, but I just don't think that they were pulled out enough because we've got the Christmas story and the teen story.
Hawkeye suffers from imposter syndrome, basically. What average man wouldn't if they spent a decade sandwiched between Chris Hemsworth Thor and Chris Evans's Captain America. I mean, the musical is a cheeky reference to the fakeness of it all and the hilarious sequence that takes place at a live-action role-players event. Is that, do you think, the series' strength? His sort of everyman quality? They seem to have taken his grumpiness and turned it into strong, die-hard, why won't you just let me spend Christmas with my family?
Yes, there is definitely that. You know, I'm getting too old for this.
Yes.
But, you know, there was a glimpse of his fatherly nature in Age of Ultron, where he pep talks Scarlet Witch into being an Avenger and coming out of that door and trashing all those robots. Now, this is clearly an extension of that. That's his nature, because if he doesn't have that, he's just a guy with a bow and arrow. I mean, what's the point of a bow and arrow in a world where even the Winter Soldier's got a light machine gun? It's madness. Not the band. you know, it's this character is inherently bonkers. Kate's new possible father-in-law is the swordsman, who is, you know, again,
maybe we think.
Well, he's got the same name.
Yes.
And he's bought a sword. So,
but like I said, they've mixed everything
else. Yes, that is
true. They've mixed everything else up. So I'm not sure.
But I'm very interested in him.
Yeah. And
Tony Dalton is a really great casting choice, as is Vera Farmiga as Eleanor.
Yeah.
I'm very interested in their story arc. I thought it was funnier and lighter than most offerings.
Yes.
I thought it was age and season appropriate. That's what I thought.
Yeah.
It's nice to have something that doesn't involve a character, a Marvel character at the center, suffering some huge, you know, psychological breakdown and existential question. It's just, it's light.
Yeah, it's nice. It's you know, it is a bit fluffier than some of them. You're right. Mm-hmm. And it's a nice change of tone. And this is something I've also often thought, is that the genius of the Feige Marvel Empire is that they've created a universe in which they can tell very many different stories. You know, they could do a musical practically. You know, they could do a rom-com in this universe, and it would work because the universe is so crafted. We understand its rules.
Yeah. The first two episodes of Hawkeye are available on Disney Plus now. The series will culminate in a Christmas special finale on the 22nd of December.
And I will be reenacting the entirety of Rogers the Musical in my front room the following day.
Excellent.
We always ask our guests for a music recommendation. And Suggs, it's your turn. What's your current choice of tune that you've brought in?
I've chosen Salt. I came across them completely by accident. I heard them on Six Music, and it just hit me straight away. Really strange, eclectic mixture of modern kind of beats with Philadelphia strings sometimes, but not always. A very strange mixture of different things. Every track that they do is different from the one before. But great lyrics, really sort of righteous kind of vibes, and different singers. And anyway, I found out it's a collective from North London.
Yay!
Of course they were. It's a collective of producers who get together to do this project, and I just think it's great. And the track I've chosen is London Gangs, which I think is a great example of what I've just talked about.
Fantastic. We'll give it a listen. London Gang Salt, and we will add it to our rolling playlist, as we will Waterloo Sunset, which you can get on your info on your podcast app. Thank you so much to Suggs. It's been wonderful.
Thank you.
You've been great. We could talk for hours. We talk for days. Really, it's wonderful, isn't it? It's a shame it always has to be half an hour or so, but thank you so much.
You're welcome. Thank you very much.
Are you going to eat what's Whitstable's oysters, isn't it? I'm presuming you eat oysters every day now.
Yeah, absolutely, oysters. But it's been a disaster because, of course, you know, you've heard about the Southern Water having chucked 75,000 million tonnes of turds into the sea. Mm. The oysters took a bit of a tumble, but they're back now. They're back. Yeah, the Whitstable oysters. So that's one of my favourites, yes.
Wonderful. Well, enjoy them and have a wonderful weekend. Thank you to Suggs for your epic musical choice there. And we're at the end of the show. It's closing time chatter. What will we be discussing as we stand on Waterloo Bridge, gaze into the horizon ahead, with a warm glass of white wine from the Royal Festival Hall? Michael, what's your closing time chat?
Well, this week I've been interested in the discussion around running orders, you know, for albums.
Yes. I wonder why. Tell us.
I wonder why. Well, because Adele, who's flavour of the moment in the sense that you can't switch on any television programme without her popping up in it. It's like, and now it's over to Adele for the weather.
We had an almost physical fight last week because I adore Adele.
Well, I've got nothing.
I adore. I've got
but she's been meddling again, isn't she? Meddling with Spotify. But carry on, Michael.
Well, the thing is, this is, you know, I think if I can just peer behind the curtain for a minute, I imagine this was all done behind the scenes by lawyers months ago.
Of course, yeah.
But then the other day she tweeted that I don't really want the shuffle button on my album on Spotify, and then seemingly moments later they went, anything for you, Adele, and off it goes. Now it's greyed out. And, you know, my contention is that every album is a concept album, with the possible exception of some greatest hits albums, that there is, when you make a record, you have in your mind, as you're making it, you have this sense of how it's going to, the ebb and the flow, you know, how it's going to work.
Sequencing.
Yeah, and if it's a compilation album, if you know, or if it's a playlist that you've made for yourself, fine, you know, it can be on shuffle if that's what you want. I personally, when I build little playlists on my Spotify or iTunes or whatever, I still have this sense of a story being
too,
told.
We're creating an album.
Even though they're by different people. Mm. And I'm all, you know, I don't think you should be restrictive and say, oh, no, it should be switched off. because that's just silly. If people want to use it, people want to use it. But I think people should avoid using it if they can, because, as I say, every album is a concept album.
I agree with you in principle, but as a listener, I have the right to listen to things as I want them.
Oh, yeah.
What is, you know, what was home taping? Home taping was taping the singles off the radio and choosing
music.
The things.
It's killing music, Sean.
Spotify that killed music.
You killed music.
you know, I think we're allowed to listen to whatever the hell we like in whatever order we like. Of course, it's a concept album. Most artists do that, but that's part of their job, and she's already got paid for that. So that's fine. She's not going to notice me then plucking out or not any of the songs.
I entirely agree. But what I'm saying is I think it's good that she's brought it into the conversation.
I suppose.
You know, in the same way, if you listen to that second side of Abbey Road, it's a load of fragments that they've knocked together in that fractious Let It Be session. And then Paul and George Martin have assembled it into this kind of mad doily of creativity that flows. If those tracks were discrete tracks, would you put it on shuffle? Be madness.
And not the band again.
Again, not the band. Good point.
Alex, what's your closing time chatter?
I started last week binging on American Horror Story, the series. Mm. And I have no idea, as a huge horror fan, why this had escaped my attention. I had this weird notion in the back of my head that it was a little bit teenagey and somehow not horror enough and not dark enough. And it couldn't be further from the truth. The first, we watched the first season, Murder House, and we're now into Asylum, and they are insane as scripts and incredibly dark and really scary
and very pretty
and gory at times and really beautiful.
The imagery is very kind of remarkable.
And my God, the performances. Mm. I mean, Jessica Lange is astonishing especially across the two series, where she plays a completely different character.
Yeah. So this sounds a good counterpoint to Hawkeye, where you've gone for something dark, Alex.
Yeah.
After watching that. Sounds good. I've not seen them. So do you recommend
really?
Them?
Oh, my goodness. Well, like I said, I'm only halfway through the second series. Mm-hmm. But what I've seen so far is excellent.
So let's have a horror excellent.
Film. But it's because they're discrete. The series are discrete stories. But it's a repertory company that keeps coming back in different roles.
So interesting. Mm. It's just such a good group of actors as well.
Thumbs up.
What's yours?
Talking Pictures are now launching a streaming service next week. Hello. This is Hello Christmas. This is what I have been waiting for. Maybe it's long overdue. Maybe it was exciting tuning in at 1 o'clock to watch whatever swinging 60s film that I'd missed. But it's really, I think this is fantastic news. And I'll just probably just have a Talking Pictures Christmas of on-demand, wonderful films that they do show. I do love the way that they say, and they have to now preempt beforehand, some of the opinions.
Yes.
Some of the views.
Are a bit offensive
really, not really considered these days.
And smoking.
And we know that. We understand that. And we can be horrified by it. But as a time capsule and as the wonderful small family-run business that Talking Pictures is, I think this is wonderful news.
Yeah,
and I was really cheered by this. It's great.
It's such a good channel.
Yeah. That would be my only trigger warning on Get Back, actually. You just mentioned it. I haven't smoked a cigarette in 7 years. And boy, it made me want to light up. Boy, did it make me want to light up. And that's the end of the podcast. Thanks so much to the Indomitable Suggs and Linda Marrick and Michael Moran.
Thank you very much.
From Sean and myself and producers Alex Rees and Yelena Sofronievich, thank you for listening. We will see you next week.
The Culture Bunker was written and presented by Sean Pattenden with Alex Andreu. The producer was Andrew Harrison. The assistant producer was Yelena Sofronievich. An audio production was by me, Alex Rees. Theme tune by Kenny Dickinson. The Culture Bunker is a Podmasters production.
It's a busy world out there. Once you've woken up and got on top of all your WhatsApps, your texts, your emails and your DMs, then you've got another pile of stuff to get through. The news. Honestly, who's got the time? That's where Papercuts, the brand new podcast, comes in. Paper Cuts is your fast, funny tour of all the best bits of the papers, from the biggest scoops to the weirdest headlines to the definitely not made up showbiz gossip. And it's out every weekday with me, Miranda Sawyer, and a host of guests, including tip-top comedian Marcus Brigstock. Marcus, what's your favourite thing about Paper Cuts?
It's the puns. It's obviously the puns. I mean, when we go through the papers and you see what creative beauties the people who work, particularly in the tabloids, have come up with. Often I think it's pun first, then story for them. They're like, I've got one. Find a story to match this. But it's a really fun part of the podcast to see what they've come up with every day.
Especially the Daily Star.
Oh, the Star. Proud to love animals.
So if you want to be on top of the news and have a laugh while you're doing it, get Paper Cuts every day on your favourite podcast app. We're out around lunchtime, Monday to Friday. Perfect for a bit of me time in the middle of a busy day. That's Paper Cuts. We read the papers so you don't have to. Thank you.